The Talmud in Tractate Midah has a very beautiful and touching image. The Talmud discusses what are the best moments of a person's life. The best moments of a person's life. A person lives 80 years, 90 years, 100 years. What were the best times? So the best times, the Talmud said, are before he's born. The best times are in the womb. Because in the womb, the Talmud says, it's an ideal. It's unbelievable. There are no worries. There's no pain. The baby's sitting curled up in a fetal position. Food is coming in through the stomach. The eyes are closed. The mouth is somewhat open. And there's an angel there. And the angel has a candle lit on top of the baby's head. And with this candle, the baby can see from one end of the world to the other. And the angel is teaching the child all of the Torah. Everything is being imparted to this child. And as the child grows, finally reaches the stage when he can exit the womb opens. The baby starts to come out the canal, and as the baby is coming out that channel, the angel touches it, and it's about to forget everything. And right before it forgets, the angel says, "Swear to me. Swear that you will always be a tzaddik. You will always be righteous. You will never be a Rasha. You will never be wicked. Swear that you will always be working hard. Even if the world tells you, oh, you're a big tzaddik, don't believe them. Because if you'd believe them, you'd stop striving. Don't believe them. In your own eyes, you'll consider yourself a Rasha." And then the angel lets go, and suddenly it all disappears. All the Torah that the baby learned is forgotten. The candle is gone, the angel is gone, the oath is forgotten. The baby starts screaming, he's in this world. That's what the Talmud says in Tractate Midah. This powerful moment. The best possible moment. And there's an oath, and then it's all gone. And then life starts for the 60, 70, 80, 90, 100, 120, 130 years that a person lives. And then when he dies, he goes back to heaven, starts to get back to those idyllic moments. Question?
Okay. So how can a baby promises not to be a tzaddik?
Yes.
If there are people in the world who do bad things.
Good. Okay. Good. Excellent question. So Benji asks, if every baby has promised to be a tzaddik, what happened to that promise in all the sinners? All the sinners of the world. What's going on with that promise? Well, on a basic level, we've all forgotten that promise. So that raises another question. Then why take a promise if I'm going to forget it? What's the point of a promise if I don't remember it? What's the meaning of this promise? Let's add to this question. Is a baby jaded? Is a baby cynical? The soul, as it's entering the world, is a pure soul. Why would it need to promise? Why does it need to take an oath? Why is it not sufficient to just say, okay, I'm going to try my best? So here the answer is, as we've learned before. A person only utilizes a small fraction of a person's abilities. We utilize maybe 10% of the mind. Maybe 5% of our physical strength, 30% of our physical strength. We use a fraction of our abilities. The Hebrew word for shvua, the Hebrew word for oath, has as its root the word sheva, seven. God made the world in 7 days. Seven is a number that represents all the power in the world, all the abilities of the world. When a person takes an oath, a person is arousing within himself every possible ability. So that's why the number seven is applicable, because all of the forces in himself are aroused. He's charging up. He's arousing. He's awakening all the abilities within himself. He's adding strength to every fiber of his soul. Every fiber of the soul is strengthened and inspired and triggered and lit up and fired up. And so before the baby comes into this world, the baby swears, I will be righteous. I will not be wicked. Even if everyone tells me I'm righteous, I'm not going to stop working, I'm going to keep considering myself as if I am wicked. Because the baby is charging up every fiber of the soul. God is charging up every fiber of the soul for this mission. This mission takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of energy to be righteous. It's a constant challenge and a constant struggle and a constant battle. But then the oath is forgotten. So Benji asks, why take an oath if it's going to be forgotten? And here we get to a very deep secret. In holiness, there's a law of the conservation of spirit. The same way Einstein taught of the conservation of matter, there is the conservation of spirit. Einstein taught that matter never disappears. It just changes form. So if you destroy matter, it just changed form to become energy. And so if you can split apart an atom, a little piece of mass, it doesn't disappear. It now becomes an unbelievable amount of energy. If that's true in the physical world, that's true in the spiritual world. There is the law of conservation of soul matter. The law of the conservation of the spirit. A spiritual achievement never disappears. It just takes on a different form. And the form that it takes is that it remains in an incipient potential state. It becomes an impression. There is a concept of impressions of holiness. Impressions of holiness underlie so much of Jewish practice and belief. And so an oath, which is really a charging up of every ounce of energy, every potential power within a person, even an oath that's forgotten remains. It remains and it leaves an impression. It remains in a potential form. It's still there. Let's delve a little bit into the concept of impressions of holiness. I'll start with a story. In the 1800s, I'm sorry, the 18th century, the 1700s, there were tzaddikim, there were pious people that very much wanted to investigate themselves. Are they really, really excited on Shabbos because it's Shabbos? Or maybe their feelings of Shabbos are not really because of Shabbos. Their feelings of Shabbos are because of all the surroundings. The fact that they're with family, and they're wearing Shabbos clothing, and they're davening special prayers, and they're not doing work. But maybe if they would do the same on Tuesday, they'd have the same feelings. And if they'd have the same feelings on a Tuesday, if one Tuesday they didn't do any work, and they wore Shabbos clothing, and they had a Shabbos meal, and they ate the challah, and they had the tefillos, and they felt the feelings of Shabbos, then that would mean that when they feel the feelings of Shabbos on Shabbos, it's not really coming from Shabbos. It's not a real, genuine achievement of spirituality. It's that they're fooling themselves to think that they're getting Shabbos. But really, it's all the environment that's giving them those feelings. But it's not the Shabbos that's giving them the feeling. So what did they do? They made an experiment. One Tuesday, they didn't do work, and they lit candles on Monday night. And they said Kabbalah Shabbos. And they wore Shabbos clothing, and they sat down to eat challah with the family. Guess what? They started to have the feeling that they have on Shabbos. They were devastated. Said, oh my gosh. All of our religiosity isn't yet genuine. We haven't yet really gotten to feel Shabbos. Because if what we would be feeling is really Shabbos, then on Tuesday acting like Shabbos wouldn't give us the feeling of Shabbos. And here we have the feeling of Shabbos. they went to the great Chose of Lublin, Rabbi Horowitz, and they started crying. They said, Rebbe, we've been fooling ourselves. Our religiosity isn't genuine. We get excited on Shabbos and we think we're getting excited by Shabbos. But here on a Tuesday we acted like Shabbos and we got excited. Does that mean Shabbos is not exciting us? It's all the actions that are exciting us. It's all the show that's exciting us. So Chose said, did you wear Shabbos clothing? He said, yeah, we wore Shabbos clothing. He said, so it is Shabbos that's exciting you. Because when you keep Shabbos and you wear Shabbos clothing, so you leave an impression of Shabbos on the clothing. There is a little bit of the spirit of Shabbos in these clothes, in this suit, in this tie, in this, you know, this bekisha, this strimel, this gartel, this kapata. There is a Shabbos in it. And that's what got you excited. But it really is Shabbos that's getting you excited. In holiness, if you once had an experience of Shabbos with these clothing, there's something left of Shabbos in the clothing. And even when you wear it during the week, you might have a little bit of a feeling of Shabbos because of the holiness that's left there. There is an impression of holiness that stays. There's the law of conservation of soul. The law of conservation of soul is that if you had a religious experience, even if it's no longer in an acute state, it stays in a latent state. There is an impression that's left from the religious experience. The religious experience is left on some level. This is the concept of impressions of holiness. This is the whole idea of why in Judaism there is a concept that one should pray in a set place. Talmud says, Tractate Brachot, you should have a place where you pray. Let's say you're in the Beit Midrash downstairs. Stake out a homestead. Find a table, a certain chair on that table, and pray there. Pray there today, and tomorrow when you come, go to that same spot and pray in that spot. And the next day, pray again in the same spot. And the next day, again in the same spot. Keep praying in a set spot. It's called the Makom Kavua L'Tfila. A set place for prayer. Sometimes you go into a synagogue and say, this is my makom kavua, this is my set place, so don't sit here, this is my place. What's the big deal? Why should you pray in a set place? Why? Yeah, but why? The Gemara in fact says that. The Gemara says, one who prays in a set place, Elokei Abraham Israel, the God of Abraham is in his place. Why pray in the same place? What's that?
Because every time you pray,
Awesome. Yeah, awesome. Eli, awesome! Every time you pray, you are making an impression of holiness. And that rubs off. To give it a little bit more of explanation, to explain further, the world around us, the air, is filled with damaging agents. Science has discovered this. There are germs. There are all sorts of viruses that are floating throughout the air. There's pollution in the air. If that's true in a physical way, that's true in a spiritual way too. We are here in the physical world. The air of the physical world is filled with all sorts of spiritual obstacles. A person's trying to pray. He's trying to get his prayers through the air. It's not so easy to get the prayers through the air. In fact, the mystics say there are 390 obstacles. And that's why the word shamayim, heavens, in Gematria equals 390. Because you have to get through 390 heavens to get up to the throne of glory. And that's why the Chazan, the head of the synagogue, is called Shliach Tzibur, the emissary of the community. Shliach Tzibur is called a Shatz. The acronym, the two letters that spell Shliach Tzibur, the word Shliach has the letter Shin, the word Tzibur, the letter Tzadi, Shatz. Shatz in Gematria is 390. Because he, the Shliach Tzibur, has to clear the air, has to get through the 390 heavens, get through the Shamayim, to get the prayers up to God. There's a lot of barriers. There are many, many barriers preventing us from connecting with God. So that's why we should pray in a set place. I come to this place, and maybe on a Monday, I'm feeling very, very broken. My sister's in the hospital. My son maybe is not feeling well. I've suffered a loss in my community. And I feel broken. And I start crying. And I pour out my heart to God, and I say, God Almighty, please, please, save us. Send the healing to those who aren't well. Send strength to those who are despondent. Give a sense of hope to those who are despairing. And I pour out my heart. I come back on Wednesday. And now, thank God, my son is out of the hospital. My sister's out of the hospital. And the people in the community are feeling more upbeat. And my prayer is not as heartfelt. But if I pray in the same place where I prayed on Monday, then Monday's prayer is still there. There's the law of conservation of soul. There is the law of the impressions of holiness. Monday's prayer left an impact. And so when I come on Wednesday and I don't have the feelings that I had on Monday, if I stand in the same place, then that place, some of those 390 barriers have been cleared because of the force of Monday's prayer. And so it's easier on Wednesday to also clear through those barriers and have a heartfelt, real prayer. The holiness that's left in that place from Monday can be more easily aroused to help my prayer on Wednesday. The law of the conservation of soul is that if there was a spiritual achievement, a true spiritual achievement, there is something left from that spiritual achievement. And because there's something left, it can be re-aroused, it can be reawoken. It can be awakened again. It's easier to awaken it because there's something left. The child is made to swear, and an oath really means an arousal of all the forces within the person. But then the child forgets the oath. But the oath left an impression. And because there's an impression of the oath there, that impression can be re-aroused. An impression of holiness can be re-aroused. It can be reawakened. And then a person has tremendous strength. This is an amazing concept. The impressions that are left, the power of being in a set place. You don't know when, but sometime you might have a real heartfelt prayer. And that prayer leaves an impression, and then you can re-arouse that impression. It becomes easier to pray in that place. There was a Hasidic Rebbe. His name was Rabbi Shmuel Bornstein, the Shemi Shmuel. And he was the Rebbe of Sachachat. He had a son, Rabbi Aaron Yeshua, Rabbi Aaron Yeshaya maybe. His son wrote a biography of his father called Maros Hadesha. It's a fascinating, Mire Hadesha. It's a fascinating, fascinating biography because it's so rare to have an unvarnished, completely honest portrayal from the inside of what a father was like and what a great tzaddik was like. Very, very interesting. Shemi Shmuel apparently was a very demanding person, very disciplined, very strong, had a real desire for perfection. He didn't want to be supported as a rabbi, because actually the ideal is that a rabbi not be supported for teaching Torah, but have some profession, and Torah should be free. So he tried to be in the wine business, because he wanted to be the ideal. It didn't work out. He had to take a salary in the end. He just couldn't make a living. But he tried. He tried. The last mitzvah of the Torah is to write a Torah scroll. The people fulfill it by contributing towards the writing of a Torah scroll. He wrote a Torah scroll himself. He wrote a whole Torah scroll. And it was very perfect. Took him a couple of years. And he wrote it himself. And he was a mohel. And he did it all himself. And everything he did was with a sense of precision and discipline. In his yeshiva, or his chassidish shul, he would not allow anybody to push. No, everybody has their place. You sit in your place, come, organize, stand in your place. Everything was organized, precise, very disciplined man. During World War I, he went through terrible times of persecution, of wandering, of being away from his chassidim, away from his town. And if you read the Divrei Torah that he delivered in World War I, he never once mentions what's going on. It's the same as when before the war. He was a very strong, disciplined person. This is the way I serve God. I serve God. The war going on, I'm still serving God the same way. I'm not changing. No impact at all, but what was going around him. Very, very strong person. One of the things that he mentions in the biography about his father, that his father had a room, and basically he spent the majority of his life in that room. It was off to the side of the house. He would eat his breakfast there. Every morning, every lunch, be the same food. Be this bowl of porridge, nondescript, without much taste. He would eat it in absolute silence, quietly, with a little piece of bread, some tea. And that's what he ate for breakfast, that's what he ate for lunch, every single day, no change. He would eat in silence, meditating. And in that room where he would eat, he would learn with his kids. When people needed a blessing, they would come to that room and he would give them a blessing. He used to pray in that room. He would not pray with a minyan. He would pray in that room. At the end of his life, he wasn't well. They took him to Otvotsk, which was a place where I guess they had natural springs. And unfortunately, he passed away. When he passed away, they drove back at night to Sakhachev. They brought his body to that room. They eulogized him in that room. Why was everything in that room? I think for the same reason. His prayers were in that room. They left an impression of holiness. His learning was in that room. It left an impression of holiness. His Seder meal was in that room. It left an impression of holiness. So the Chassidim realized, this is who he was. You want to eulogize him? Go back to that place. Because there's the law of the impressions of holiness, the conservation of spirit. Holiness, once achieved, stays. Just not in a manifest way. It stays in a latent way. And that latent holiness is more easily aroused. Is more easily woken up. That's the Sakhachev Rebbe's room. It was his Makom Kavua L'Tfilas, set place for prayer, to go deeper. What is the holiness of the land of Israel today? Why does it have a state of holiness? Because of all the impressions of holiness. All the holiness that was put into it. All the mitzvos that were performed there. All the prayers that were recited there. All the prophecy that was received there. It has all left an impression of holiness. The Temple Mount. Today, there's a Muslim obscenity there. They have their Mosque of Omar on the Temple Mount. And they have the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And they have the Dome of the Rock. And they're walking around in the Temple Mount. There's no Beit HaMikdash. There are no sacrifices. Why is the Temple Mount still holy in the eyes of Jewish tradition? When we pray here in the United States, we turn towards the Temple Mount. If we don't know the direction of the Temple Mount, we should picture the picture of the temple in our mind and pray thinking of it. Why? It's not there. The Arabs are there. It's not there physically, but it's there spiritually because an impression of holiness remains. The Roshem, the Hebrew word for impression is Roshem. The Roshem of holiness remains. The impression of holiness remains. All the great mitzvahs that were performed on the Temple Mount. All the sacrifices that were offered on the Temple Mount. The binding of Isaac. The sacrifices that Noah offered. The altar that Adam built. And that Cain offered sacrifices on. All, I'm not sure Adam built the altar. But Cain's altar that was built there. All of these sacrifices are still there. The impression is still there. What is the idea of going to the Western Wall? The Western Wall is the wall closest to where the Holiest of Holies was. The Holiest of Holies had the most manifest holiness. Prophecy would be an overflow of the holiness of the holiness of the Holiest of Holies. So the Western Wall still has an impression of holiness. The impression of holiness is why we go to the Western Wall. Because if the place where there is an impression, that's where you can wake it up again. That's the specialness of the Western Wall. That's the specialness of the Temple. That's the specialness of the land of Israel. In Halacha, we we find the idea of an impression of holiness as well. The halacha states that the full holiness of the land of Israel is only there when most Jews live in the land of Israel. Even so, even though most Jews are not living in the land of Israel, it still has a holiness. Why? It may not have the full holiness, but it has a holiness that's left from what was once there. It has an impression of holiness. Let's go deeper. Tefillin, the word for tefillin is connected to what other word? When you hear the word tefillin,
tefillah.
Exactly, tefillah, prayer. Kabbalists teach that prayer is really a time of achieving a new level of consciousness, a new level of mind. The goal of prayer, and I can't say that I get there, or that I get there often, but the goal of a real prayer is that through a prayer, a person reaches a whole new level of attachment with God, a whole new level of connection with the Almighty, called mochin the godless, expanded consciousness, elevated consciousness. That's the idea of prayer. What is the tefillin? Tefillin is to keep the prayer with us the whole day. Ideally, tefillin should be worn all day. Because ideally, that expanded consciousness stays with the person all day. Now, how can you say that the expanded consciousness stays with him all day when he's in his office making phone calls and making arrangements and doing things and writing things and making out checks and paying bills? It stays with him in a latent state. It stays with him as a roshan, as an impression. The idea of tefillin is to keep the impression of the tefillah all day. Each box of tefillin is called a tefillah. It's the impression from the prayer that's supposed to stay with us all day. Another example of impressions of holiness, we say Shema in the morning and in the evening. We say Shema in the morning to accept upon ourselves and to declare a commitment to serving God. That commitment that's declared stays with us in an impression form. That's why we don't have to say Shema at Mincha. But at night, it's already a new day. We need to say Shema all over again because the impression has worn off. The tefillin is an impression of the tefillah. It's an impression of the prayer for the entire day. And now we get to a depth. When God first made the world was in a much more ideal state. It was in a much holier state. Let's go deeper. There is the physical and the spiritual. In the human being, the body and the soul. The soul is very, very holy. The body is not seemingly holy. The way to disconnect from the soul to be extraordinarily attached to the body. The more one is attached to the body, the more one is disconnecting from the soul. Let's just think of Shema. V'lo taturu acharei levavchem v'acharei neichem asher atem zonim achrihem. Do not stray after your eyes and after your heart, which is what leads you to stray following them. A person who sees a food item that he wants, body gets hungry, eye it's not kosher, but the body wants it, so he goes and he eats it. Strays away from God through the body. The body, when it is the superior master over man, leads man to disconnect from God. What is the ideal state? The ideal state is when a body is transformed into not something opposing God, but something which actually reveals God. The ideal state is when the body is a soul. When the body has been elevated to the level of a soul, that's the ideal state. That's the whole idea of revival of the dead. What's the revival of the dead? Jewish belief is the revival of the dead is that the body's going to come back to life. What body will come back to life? The body that will come back to life is the body that is itself a soul. The parts of the body that did God's work, that's what's going to come back to life. The parts of the body that have been melded with and bonded with the soul is what's going to come back to life. Let's go deep. Let's go very deep. The body is a vessel. The soul is the source. The body is a recipient. The soul is the source. The body lives so long as the soul is in it. If heaven forbid a person's soul leaves his body, the body is dead. The body then decays and disappears. Why is the body to be buried? Again, because of an impression of holiness. Because since there was once a soul in the body, so the soul leaves an impression on the body. So even when the soul leaves, and a person dies, and the soul now is back in the Garden of Eden, but the impression of the soul is still in the body. And that impression is why the body has to be treated with respect, and it has to be buried, and it can't be burned. And it can't be defiled in Jewish thought. Yeah, question?
So, I don't know, that just started to get you thinking about, like, Siddurs and Torah scrolls and everything. Say the scroll isn't in the Torah, in like, the case anymore. Is, like, the wood, the handles and all that stuff, do those need to be buried? They can't just be thrown
very
away.
Good. Correct. Any item that serves the Torah scroll itself, whether it be the wood or the pointer, have to be buried. They can't be thrown out. Why does a Torah scroll that is not kosher buried? Because there's an impression of holiness in it. It's not kosher anymore. Its soul has left it, but an impression stays, because impressions leave a mark. The body has an impression of soul on it. And that's where the holiness of the body comes from. That's where the body has to be buried.
I feel like for the body, there's no soul that's going to take over again. So, I mean, it had an impression of holiness on it.
But the impression stays forever. Impressions stay forever. Holiness is forever. There's a law of conservation of soul. It's not just that there was one soulfulness and now the soul left, so okay, get rid of the body. Go incinerate it, heaven forbid. No, there's soul there. There's an impression there. There's conservation of soul. Bury the body. And even after the body decays, and even after the body disappears, our tradition teaches that there's one part that doesn't decay. There's a bone called the luz bone on the vertebrae of the spine. And this bone doesn't decay. And out of this bone, God will bring this body back in the revival of the dead. Because as we've learned, when you have a holy experience, and the holy experience leaves, you had a great prayer on Monday, and now it's Friday, and you don't feel the way you felt Monday. You don't even feel like praying. But when you go back to the same place, since there's an impression of Monday's prayer there, you can wake up Monday's prayer. Since there was soul in the body, that soul is still left in some level in the loose bone. And then the loose bone can be re-aroused and a new body comes out of it. That's how the revival of the dead comes. You wear tefillin all day to keep the impression. The Kabbalists used to wear tefillin all day to keep the impression of davening with them so that they could re-arouse the davening. They could feel that impression still there. Yeah, question.
I was wondering, does this relate any reason why we can't see the body? Like, why is it a closed casket? Like at funerals?
Maybe because, well, there's an idea that in Judaism we have a closed casket as a sign of respect. As a sign of respect. And maybe this is really the depth of what the respect is. The respect is, how dare I look at only an impression of soul? This person who once was a vibrant soul, it's insulting to look at now and to look and see now the impression of soul. It has to be closed. But that's why the body needs such respect. Because it's a utensil of soul, and it has an impression of soul still in it. It still has that holiness in it. And because there's an impression, it can be re-aroused. The challenge of life is to transform our bodies into souls. The soul is the source, and the body is the recipient. So to understand the secret of life, Let's think about sources and recipients. A good example is the sun and the moon. The sun gives light. The moon receives the light of the sun and reflects that light back down to earth. So the sun is the source and the moon is the recipient. We can say that the sun is to soul what the moon is to the body. That just like the sun gives life to the moon, gives light to the moon receives and then reflects it, the soul gives life to the body, which receives and reflects it out. So we get here to a very deep point. Initially, on day three of creation, a question. Yeah.
Okay, so the whole thing with only Jews have souls type of thing, how did that come in?
Okay, so I don't think that only Jews have souls.
I mean, I've heard that.
Where do they say that?
I think every human being has a soul. There are different types of soul, though. I think that the soul of the Jew is different than the soul of other human beings. But every human being has a soul. Ultimately, every human being has a soul. We are all descendants of Adam. We all have a soul. Every human being has a soul. It's another topic, but we'll get to it. We'll get to that topic, God willing. The role of the Jewish people. We'll get to that topic. But for now, we're dealing with the topic of impressions of holiness, or the rule of the conservation of soul, the rule of conservation of spirit, the rule that holiness stays. That's the topic for today, that holiness stays, that holiness lasts. On day four of creation, the Torah says that initially God made two great lights. And then it says, the great light for the day and the small light for the night. Rashi quotes a statement of the Midrash. Initially, God made two great lights, equal lights. The sun was bright. The moon was just as bright. But then the moon came to the sun, came to God. And the moon said to God, God, how could there be two kings both using the same crown? How could there be two kings? In other words, implying, make me the king and make the sun smaller. There should be one guy in charge. But God says, okay, you become smaller. And you know what? Now you're going to be at night and the sun will be by the day. Kabbalists teach the moon represents the recipient. All the recipients of the world are represented by the moon. The body, as we've learned, compared to the soul, is a recipient compared to a source. So the body is like the moon, and the soul is like the sun. Initially, the sun and the moon were both equally great lights. In other words, initially there was a world where the soul and the body were equally great. Where the body revealed, where the body was soulful, just like the soul is soulful. But then the body said, how could you have two kings on the same crown? So God said, go become smaller. So the body is less than the soul. Let's explain. Let's understand. The moon is the recipient. To receive means to not have of oneself, to not have one's own amount, to empty oneself up, to receive from somewhere else. Let's take a light fixture. When I'm sitting in the room, the lampshade that's around the lamp is what's giving me light. The truth is the lampshade itself gets its light from the light bulb. If the lampshade has a color, if it's red, if it's blue, if it's dark brown, the light from the bulb gets dimmed. If the lampshade has nothing of its own, it's a clear lampshade. It's absolutely clear. There's nothing to it. It's completely empty. It's completely receiving. then the light from the lampshade is the same as the light from the bulb. The light of the moon was the same as the light of the sun when the moon was completely submissive to the sun. When the moon had no identity of itself, when it was completely surrendering to the sun, then the light of the sun shone right through it. The light that you were getting from the moon was the same as the light that you got from the sun. That the moon and the sun were the same size. But once the moon said, I want to be king, I want to be the best, I want to be the best, I want to be king, is an assertion of ego, an assertion of self. I have some color. I'm blue, I'm red, I'm green. I'm not just completely subservient. I'm not completely slavish. I'm not completely empty. I'm not completely a vessel. I'm something. Oh, then by definition, you're less. The moment you're something, you're less. The moment you're something, then you're receiving, but you're receiving with yourself. Then what you receive is less than what the source was. It's like a lampshade with color. Ideally, the physical becomes spiritual when the physical is completely annulled and subservient to its source, the spiritual. A body which is completely submissive to soul, where soul shines right through the body, then that body is a light like the light of the soul. What is the revival of the dead? What is the revival of the dead? Is that those parts of the body that were subservient to soul completely come back to life. They come back to life. They live like the soul lives because they are part of soul. They are submissive to the soul. They are appended to the soul. They are part of the soul. God made initially two great lights. In other words, initially the light of the moon was really the light of the sun. Because the moon was completely subservient to the sun. And the light of the moon was the light of the sun shining right through it. So initially it was two great lights, because it was the sun by the day. And then at night you had the sun again, because the sun shone right through the moon. But once the moon said, I'm something, I want to be king. So now already the light at night is not just, it's not the light of the sun. It's a reflection of the light of the sun. It's not the complete light of the sun. So now you have a big light and you have a smaller light. You have day and you have night. You have a time of darkness, night. And you have day, a time of day. But initially, though, it was light of the sun and light of the moon being all one great light. Then it was lost. We have a rule of the conservation of soul. We have a rule of conservation of spirit. It means this level is still there. This level is there. There's an impression of this level that's left. There are people who can arouse this level. There are certain people that are unbelievably submissive. And through being submissive to the source, to their soul shines right through them. How did they reach such a level? Because they were able to re-arouse and reawaken. The light of the moon equaling the light of the sun. The impression of that initial state of day four before it was lost. I'll give you an example. Moshe Rabbeinu. Moses. Listen to what the Torah says about Moses. Moses, at age 120, was completely vigorous. Wasn't old at all. Because it was soul shining through his body. Moses, the angel of death, couldn't take him. The forces of physicality couldn't take him. Only God himself could take Moses' soul out of his body. Moses, I would be 100% sure his body never decayed. I'm sure his body is still the way it was, because it's all soul. Because Moses, in the Torah, is the most humble of people. Moses says about himself, what are we? We're nothing. Moses is the paragon of humility. What is humility? Humility is to be the right type of vessel. Humility is to be the right type of recipient. To be the right type of created being. The really created being who really feels I'm created, I'm nothing of my own, the Creator shines right through him. God's light shines right through him. The soul shines right through him. The Hebrew words, the two great lights, are Shnei Me'orot HaGedolim. The first letters are Shin Mem Hei, spelled Moshe. Moshe was able to be Moshe by arousing the impression that was left from the state of Shnei Me'orot HaGedolim, of two great lights, the state of the moon being completely submissive to the sun. And then there are two great lights if the moon is the same as the sun. Nathan, a question.
Moshe directly defied God's will when he hit that rock with a stick to get water instead of talking to it?
It's true. Moshe did have a failure. He did have a failure. But, you know, the heights, you know, this is life. Life is that you go up and down. Even Moshe has failures. But the heights that Moshe reached when he was on his heights was the level of Shnei Me'orot HaGedolim. The level of being completely submissive to the will of God, complete surrender to the knowledge of God. Talmud says Moshe Rabbeinu was the one who saw through a clear window pane. Because Moshe himself was a clear window pane. He was a vessel that was completely submissive. There was nothing of it. So the light bulb shines right through such a lampshade. There's nothing of it to reduce the light. It's the greatness of Moshe. Shnei Me'orot HaGedolim. Yeah, question.
So I'm kind of confused because I feel like I know that God doesn't want us to like be egotistical and all that stuff.
Right.
But don't we sometimes need to stand up for ourselves? And I mean, like, I don't know, the story that I heard with the moon and the sun was that like the moon and the sun, they were both equal. And then the moon went to God and was like, well, one of us needs to be better than the other. We can't have two things that are equal. One has to be king. Then God made the moon smaller because the God's like, well, I'm the king. You guys are my servants. So, like, that's, it's like, it fits in with a different, I think it was like a parsha or something. But, like, it was just like, I feel like you can still, I guess, are you talking about standing up to God or are you just talking about standing up in general? Like standing up for yourself. Like, I guess those
but I think here there's an insight here which is really shocking. If somebody completely surrenders to God, then he doesn't ever stand up for himself. He just stands up for God's sake. And sometimes for God's sake he needs to stand up. But let's say there's a terrible desecration of God going on. So he tries to stop it. He might protest. He doesn't care about himself. He just cares about God. And that's a whole other way of living. That's a way of living which is much more closer to the state of two great lights, where the recipient, the human, is completely surrendering to the source, to the soul, to the Almighty. Completely, complete surrender. Now this level, the level of two great lights, was lost. Our world is not a world of two great lights. We have light of the sun by day, and at night it's night. And we only have a little bit of light of the moon. Because we don't have that level of two great lights. What we have, unfortunately, is that we are arrogant. And we do stand up for ourselves and want what's good for us. And aren't completely, completely submissive to the will of heaven. Unfortunately.
Unfortunately. God sometimes wants us to stand up.
For him. To stand up for him.
Why would he... I don't know, it's hard for me to believe that like God would give us so many opportunities. And like they could all be tests, of course, but I mean, like God would give us so many opportunities to stand up for ourselves, and like he wants us to be self-dependent, but like to have him in mind. I don't know, it's just like all this different stuff, like I just think there's many ways of looking at it, and
God willing, we'll get on other occasions, we'll get to some of those also.
Sorry.
Not at all.
Here there's an amazing point.
Amazing, amazing point. We learned that there was an ideal world. A world where the sun and the moon are the same. And it's an ideal world because the moon is completely subservient to the sun. That ideal world was then lost. But an impression from the ideal world is left. And since an impression from the ideal world is left, it can be re-aroused. The great humble people of all time, Moses, Rabbi Akiva, they are re-arousing these ideal worlds. And because the impression was left in the ideal world, that's what enabled them to become so humble and reach such levels. Rabbi Akiva, the Talmud says, is called Rabbi Akiva Stinta, Rabbi Akiva who doesn't have a name, the anonymous one. He's called the anonymous one. His imprint is all over the Mishnah and all over the Talmud. But he's called the anonymous one because he surrenders himself to the will of God. He surrenders to God fully. And that's what makes him the anonymous one. God shines right through him. It's God's Torah through him. It's not his Torah, it's God's Torah. Complete surrender. And how did he reach such complete surrender? Because he was able to connect with the level of the two great lights. Again, this is all insights from the Hasidic world, and especially from my teacher, Rav Mordechai Silver. This is why kosher food items have two characteristics. A kosher animal has to have split hooves and has to chew its cud. Why does it need characteristics? Why does it need signs? The concept of signs is that if you have a lost object, you return a lost object with signs, with markers. These items were part of the holy realm. And since they were part of the holy realm, they still have characteristics of holiness. That's the signs of the kosher animal. The signs of the kosher animal, the fact that they once had, there's a sign is the impression of the holiness that they once were part of. There's still a sign of holiness there. They chew their cud, they rise up, they go higher and higher. They have split hooves, they separate from that which is evil. There's an impression of holy concepts in them, and the impression of the holy concepts shows up as signs. Those are the things you can eat. The things that were once part of the holy realm, we can still eat. That which isn't part of the holy realm, we don't eat. Tefillin. Tefillin have to be made out of kosher animals. Menamuter beficha. Talmud says you're only allowed to make tefillin out of a kosher animal. Why out of a kosher animal? Why is it significant? I'm not eating the tefillin. If I'm eating it, so it has to be kosher. Why? But this is about eating. The answer is that those animals that I can eat, they have signs, they have a revealed or a more open impression of the holiness that they once were a part of. That which has a more open impression is what can be used for the object which is there to preserve the impression of the prayers of Shacharit. So the tefillin, that impression should stay with objects that are still holy. This is a tremendous thought, the level of impressions, the importance of impressions. Another example of the concept of impressions we find in the Zohar. The Zohar says that the patriarchs, they fulfilled mitzvot with normal physical activities. For example, Jacob. We have a whole story in the Bible where Jacob takes these sticks and he peels them and he has sheep in front of them. The sheep are looking at the sticks. The Zohar says that through that process of peeling the sticks, Jacob was achieving what a Jew today achieves when he puts on tefillin. The secret of tefillin was achieved through those sticks. In other words, there was a time before the Torah was given where the lights of mitzvos, the sparks of mitzvos, were all over the physical world. Now those sparks have been taken from the physical world and they are in the particular activities of mitzvah. If I don't put on tefillin, if I peel sticks, I'm not going to have the achievement of peeling on tefillin. The impression on my soul is not going to be achieved by the sticks. But the fact that it once was achievable through the sticks leaves an impression. And that's what enables us to use the physical item in spiritual ways. And to lift up physical items and make them into soulful items. Because there's an impression of holiness that's left. There's an impression of the level of two great lights that's left. There's an impression of the prayers that's left, and that's expressed through the set place of prayer. There's an impression of holiness that's left. That's why it's important to pray in a set place. That's why you have the holy kotel. The kotel is holy because of all the prayers that have been said there, all of the impressions of holiness that have been left there. And that's what we find in Jewish tradition and idea, that there are certain objects and certain places that have a holiness that's there. And the holiness that's there is the impression that's left there. I'll share with you a couple of stories. In the 19th century, there was a yeshiva called Yeshivas Volozhin. The head of the yeshiva was a rabbi by the name of Rav Itzhak Volozhin. Now, during that time, in the 19th century in Russia, it was a terrible period of persecutions. The Russian Tsar used to send out his soldiers to kidnap Jewish boys, and Jews would then be forcibly conscripted into the Tsar's army for 25 years, and put under tremendous pressure, physical and psychological, to convert to Russian Orthodoxy. There were many ignorant Jews who were ignorant through no fault of their own, because they were forced to serve in the Tsar's army. So Rav Itzhak Volozhin was once walking in the forest, and he met a Jew, a Russian Jewish soldier, and he was sitting in the forest davening, didn't know much, and he was crying. Rav Itzhak said, "I am sure that someday there's going to be a yeshiva in that very spot." How did he know? Because he could feel an impression that was being made. And when a yeshiva has to get started, it needs to be in a good spot. In a spot where an impression can be aroused, because that impression will help the boys learn and grow and get close to Hashem. He said, "I know there's a yeshiva going to be here." They say of the great Chozov of Lublin, he was always happy. Chozov of Lublin was always happy. They say a story about a certain tzaddik. He once was sleeping in a certain place, and there was a cuckoo clock where every hour it would ring, a ding. And the clock rang, and he woke up so excited. In the morning, he said, "What's with this clock?" They said, "This clock is the clock of the Chozov of Lublin." He said, "I'll tell you why I was so excited. Because most clocks in the world, they show that time is passing. It's depressing. Another hour has passed. Another day has passed. I still haven't achieved what I should have achieved. But the Chozov of Lublin, his clock, every minute was another minute closer to Mashiach. So whenever I heard an hour ring and I could feel the impression of the Chozov of Lublin's feelings, I would wake up with such joy, Mashiach is an hour closer." Because an impression of holiness stays. There's a law of the conservation of soul. As babies, as we were entering this world, we took an oath. Taking an oath means that every part of our being was charged up. But then we forget the oath. That's why we can still have people sinning. So what was the point of the oath? The point of the oath was to leave an impression of an oath. The impression is there that we can wake up. The word for impression in Hebrew is roshem. Roshem is the letter shomer, guard. What guards us is the impressions of holiness that are within us. It's our job to wake them up. Mm-hmm.